Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, and may it please the court, it is truly my honor to be before this court this morning representing Mr. Davis. Thank you for hearing me, and along with me is Jacqueline Shapiro and Ann Hayes. The Stored Communications Act was passed in 1986. Back then, cell phones cost over $3,000. They were the size of the briefcase, and less than one half of 1% of the United States population had them. There were only 1,000 cell phone towers in the entire United States. And to give you a sense of how long ago it was, the number one song in the country was by Dionne Warwick, "That's What Friends Are For."
That doesn't sound like that long ago.
I guess it's all relative, Judge Carnes. But a lot has changed since then. Everyone has a cell phone now. Justice Roberts recently said that a visitor from Mars would view them as an appendage to us. There are literally cell phone towers everywhere. Within a mile of this courthouse, there are over 100 towers and over 1,000 antenna sites. One thing hasn't changed since the 1980s, and that is a warrant is required for long-term monitoring of our citizens. And I think the critical difference between the government and the defense in this case is looking back at those 1970s cases, those third-party cases, and the more recent cases that deal with technology. The government is stuck on Smith and Miller and discussing what those cases, they argue what those cases lead to. And I would submit to the court that those cases do not mean what the government says they mean. They do not mean that anything held by a third party is subject to government monitoring. I mean, think about what that would mean if true. Everything on our phones now are held by third parties. Everything is up in the cloud. Pictures, apps, emails, documents, our Dropbox, our websites that we visit. Even as we drive our car, things are now being stored in the cloud.
Well, fortunately for the court, we don't have to talk about everything today. We have to talk about only the facts of this case. Is that correct?
Well, of course, Judge.
And so I know you weren't the trial counsel. Are you familiar with the record?
Of course.
All right. And so in the facts of this case, the government didn't collect any data or create any data. Only Metro PCS did, correct? The third party business telephone company collected and created the data.
That is correct.
It was legitimate for them to do so. Nobody contends it was illegal for Metro PCS to collect the telephone numbers or the cell site connector.
I agree with you.
All right. And in fact, there are only two types of data that were put in evidence in this particular defendant, Mr. Davis's trial. That was the telephone numbers and the cell site location. That's the data we're looking at.
Correct.
Cell site location, and we're looking at no contents.
Agreed.
Conversation like some cases. So I'm just trying to understand the record. Now, in some cases, you might narrow down the data, but the record tells us that was not done here. If you look at the exhibits, and there are seven of them, and they're really what the government used. Would you agree with this? These are the key exhibits they put before the jury.
Absolutely, those matter.
The jury couldn't go through and analyze that data because the data didn't tell you anything. The government had to call an expert to explain the data. Would that be fair?
Of course, yes.
Okay. So when the Metro PCS produced the data, you wouldn't know. You need an expert to go through the data and tell you what it means. For example, an expert had to say, this cell type, cell site is 541, to locate it. The expert had to get a glossary and locate it, correct?
Absolutely.
I'm just trying to, before we get to argument, let's see what we have here, what we have to decide, and what we do not have to decide in this case. And I found it interesting, I wasn't aware of this until preparing for en banc, that nobody drew a radius for these cell sites for Mr. Davis's phone. It was never done in this case. That was never put in evidence. And all the government did as to evidence against Mr. Davis was put in the cell tower site from the location and the robbery.
Right.
Okay. Because they were within, say, a mile of each other, and that put him in this area of Miami. Is that correct?
I agree with you, Judge.
Okay. So what we have is a case here where, for sure, we have no precise location of Mr. Davis at any point in time. Correct?
Oh, I don't agree with that.
Well, we have only that he's in the vicinity, about a mile vicinity of the cell site. That's the most we know.
No, what the government...
Because they didn't draw a line around these documents.
No, what the government argued to the jury was that these maps showed that he was at the robbery site. I mean, that is absolutely the inference that the government argued from those maps.
I understand that's what they argued.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're talking about electronic records and whether or not the evidence from the electronic records that was in evidence violated the Fourth Amendment. Okay, and the electronic record part was only in terms of the data they put in terms of how precise the location was. They could argue what they wanted to. It was the cell site and the robbery. You agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Okay.
Of course, the Fourth Amendment doesn't just look at what...
I'm not getting to the law. I'm just asking what the facts are. I just want to know the record.
I'm with you on the facts, Judge Hull, but
okay.
I think it is important.
And one more key fact here, Mr. Davis didn't register this phone to himself. He registered in the name of Little Wayne.
That's true.
All right. And when the government went to get these documents... They don't know who Little Wayne is. They just got the telephone numbers.
No, they did. If you look at that map that you were just holding up, it doesn't say Little Wayne on it. It says Quartavius Davis. The government...
I agree with that. But yeah. When they made the application, they put, and the order reads, the cell number. It doesn't have a name in it.
Right, because they knew that cell number was Davis's cell number. They didn't know what name was associated. They asked for that cell number because that was the cell number.
But you agree he registered it under a fictitious name.
Sure.
Because he knew they might be able to track his calls.
Oh, I don't think that was going through Mr. Davis's mind.
We don't know what was going through his mind, do we?
Fair point.
You would agree with me that it doesn't matter what was going through his mind because it's both subjective and objective.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I agree with you, Judge.
And I appreciate your candid answers to those questions. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think those facts change the analysis as to whether the Fourth Amendment applies. Remember, the Fourth Amendment doesn't just apply to what evidence was introduced into trial. It deals with whether there was a search in the first instance. They got 67 days of data here, including data that went into Mr. Davis's home and out of his home. For the month of August, for example, there were 3,000 calls made from within Mr. Davis's home sector. On September 4th...
And actually, the government never mentioned that. The defense lawyer brought it out to show the difference. If you read the trial transcript, it was only on cross of the witness that the defense lawyer got into the home calls.
But Judge Hull, the Fourth
Amendment... But isn't that true?
That's true, but the Fourth Amendment...
And he did so to show that several sites connected those calls, even though he's in one location.
Yes, but okay. but the Fourth Amendment doesn't turn on what evidence was introduced at trial. It turns on what was accumulated by the government, of course. Because,
okay, one last question.
Yes.
From the 67 days, that was the day of the first robbery and the day of the last robbery.
That's actually incorrect, and I've spoken to the prosecutor about that. It starts a couple days before and it ends a couple days after.
Okay. And if they, let's assume for sake of argument, they got one day of calls. Let's say this was a one robbery case instead of a seven robbery case. What would your position be? You get one day, and they go in. They know that robbery happened at 3 o'clock, and they get calls from 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock. Would that be a they get one day, one robbery,
right.
and one day of calls. Would that be a Fourth Amendment violation?
If they didn't get a warrant, yes. They would have probable cause.
Okay, so that would be under this act. It's still they can't even get one day of these calls.
They can get them, Your Honor. They just need a warrant to get them. I'm not talking about not being able to get this data. In fact, they should be able to get the data that matters. In this case, there were 7 days in which they had probable cause for robberies, and they could have asked for a warrant and gotten that data for those 7 days. But they didn't. They got 67 days, 60 of which had nothing to do with anything. And they were able to track Mr. Davis's comings and goings on those 60 days that had nothing to do with this matter.
Mr. Marcus, is the Fourth Amendment interest, the cell site information in and of itself, or the fact that it is used to track Mr. Davis's approximate location, or a combination of both?
I don't think you can separate those two, Judge Jordan. I think they're intertwined. So I think the data is actually showing where the person is going, and that's why it's a Fourth Amendment violation. And just to tie that question to one thing that Judge Hull said, this data isn't actually, these records aren't actually created by Metro PCS as they go. And let me just explain what I mean by that. What Metro PCS is doing is they're collecting data in the aggregate for their cell phone towers to see if the network is working, to see if calls are being dropped. They never, ever, ever collect personal location data or produce that record. So they won't say where it, let's look at Marcus's cell site location data. The only time that that is actually produced and looked at is when the government asks for it. That's the only time it's created and looked at. It's not created and looked at by Metro PCS for any business purpose or on an ongoing basis. It's not on my bill. It's nothing like the records that we saw in Smith or Miller. These are my location data that we're looking at. I'm not even entitled to see it. If I were to call up Metro PCS and say, I'd like to see my location data, they would say no.
How do we know it was for no business purpose? I mean, what does the record tell us then about why they collect that?
They collect data in the aggregate, Judge Pryor. So what they do is...
How do we know, though, that in collecting it, they're not doing it for some business purpose?
They are in the aggregate. So the business purpose for their collection of data, the reason they collect it in the first place is to see whether there are dropped calls, to see whether their towers are working, whether they need more towers.
Whether you're out of a certain zone and therefore a higher rate applies?
Absolutely.
Which sounds like a business purpose to me.
Well, they do look to see if for your bill, if they need to charge more. But what they never what they never do, though, is say, let's look at the location data for a particular user. That's not something that these companies do. The only time, and in fact, this is a money-making process for them, the government pays for these records. And what the government in the Wall Street Journal, in the Washington Post yesterday, what the government's trying to do is get rid of the middleman. They're now setting up these fake towers called Stingrays, where they just steal your location data as
Counsel,
you go.
I don't think we're going to take judicial notice of the Washington Post.
Fair enough.
We don't have to decide that very difficult case. Let me go back to this case. And what they actually showed here, and I want to make sure I understand it, you would agree they never, in terms of the data, forget about what they argued, showed anything other than he was in the vicinity within a mile radius of that cell tower.
Yes,
okay.
That is what those maps show.
No, but what the data showed.
That's what those data, yes.
Everything, take the whole evidence, the most you could get. I think the government or possibly could have had an analyst do more, but they didn't. They said within a radius of about, well, really it's a mile and a half, but let's assume it's Miami. And we said, well, it might be reduced down to a mile.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so we do not have precise miles. And this is all after the fact, correct?
It is precise in that.
They didn't seek this till February 2011. And this all occurred in 10.
That's, to me, much more of an invasion, Your Honor.
I understand. I'm just trying to understand the case.
Yes.
And they, Metro PCS, at least one of the AMSI, say they only keep records for 6 months. I mean, there's a limited period of time they can do this.
Right. AT&T keeps them for 5 years. I mean, the different carriers keep them for different
amounts
of time.
I'm talking about this case. They keep them for 6 months. Is that what the record tells us?
Yes, Your Honor. But just in terms of this case, the reason that we have to look a little bit more broad than the facts of this case into what the technology can do now is what Justice Scalia advised us in Kylo. At that time, the thermal imager was a very, very basic thermal imager. But he said we have to make decisions based on evolving technology. Even back in 2010 to now, the technology is much, much more advanced and precise. They can now triangulate. They can now use microcells.
I agree with that. And the irony is this is actually an older technology case in many ways.
But the technology...
Is that correct? The technology is totally different now with iPhones than Mr. Davis's phones.
For cell site...
He had a flip phone, right?
I don't think
disposable flip phone registered to an alias.
But I don't think it was a flip. But Your Honor, the cell site location data, that technology is what's at issue in this case, and that's what's moving so quickly. In other words, it may have been only within a mile then, but it is within meters now. And in fact, they can track you to a particular room in a house or a particular floor in a building.
That reminds me, let's go back to Smith. Yes. And I had this question. When I went and looked at the facts in Smith v. Maryland, because I think that is a case we have to grapple with, whether it's still relevant or not, as you say.
Absolutely.
And what I was struck by in Smith is the issue in Smith arose because they went from, this is 1960s, a human operator to electronic switching. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so for the first time in history, telephone companies had dial numbers. It was a major change. Is that correct?
It was.
All right. And in fact, this gentleman, Mr. Smith, was in his home on a landline, and they were able to tell in Smith from this new technology where he placed his calls, a precise address, right?
Yes, they were able to tell.
And they knew when he called, say, my chambers, a precise address. Let's say he was accused of bribing somebody. We could tell if he called that official's chambers, a precise address.
We could.
And so actually what struck me is that because of the stationary landline era, you had precise addresses for every call. Forget about this radius. Maybe you might be within 1 mile. You were in a precise location.
That's true.
And Smith then said, we're going to assume that everybody understands advances in technology, and we're going to say a reasonable person knew, they would be able to track his calls.
No, what Smith said is that a reasonable person knew that he was dialing those numbers and someone else would know, the phone company, because it was in their course of business to keep track of those numbers, which is very, very different than Metro PCS giving the government the location data. And in fact, the big difference between Smith and what we have here is that in addition to the numbers dialed, you're getting a host of other data. When the call started, when the call ended, where the call began and where it ended, over the course of a long period of time. In Smith, you didn't even know who made the call, where, of course, here with a cell phone, it's personal. You do know it's attached to the person, as Justice Roberts
says. Well, we didn't know who made the call here because it was registered to Little Wayne. In fact, the government had to call the co-defendant to testify this phone with that number is Mr. Davis's. The government didn't know whose phone that was. Is that correct?
The government knew when it applied that that was the number associated
with... Well, but they had to prove it by calling co-defendants, one to say he used it.
Right, but
correct?
No different.
And they had to call another co-defendant who cooperated and gave him the phone to show the contact number for Quat was Mr. Davis.
Right. I mean, the question, though, is whether he had an expectation of privacy to his location, though. And so whether he used a name like the framers did when they drafted the Federalist Papers or whether he used his real name doesn't make a difference as to whether he had an expectation of privacy to his location. That's the ultimate question here.
Well, let me ask you something with respect to that, if I can, counsel. Is the expectation of privacy any greater with respect to using my phone that might yield data about location than my expectation of privacy that would inhere in my toll records?
In your?
Toll records. The reason I ask the question is grand jury can issue a subpoena without any court involvement to Verizon and say, we want all of Marcus's toll records for the last 12 months. We want to know who he called and how long he was on the phone and who called him and how long that call or those calls may have lasted. No expectation of privacy in that, the Supreme Court has told us. Do I have a greater expectation of privacy in the location?
Absolutely.
Tell me why. It doesn't jump off the page at me that I might not be equally concerned or far more concerned with somebody having toll data concerning every single call I made and received for the last 12 months.
I would point, Judge Marcus, I would point you and the court to Justice Roberts' discussion of historical location data in Riley. And he has a paragraph in that decision where he says that your location data is a different type of data in which it's very highly sensitive, different than phone records under Smith. So I would point the court to that passage. Where you go from minute to minute, in this case, they had every eight minutes, a location point for Mr. Davis over the course of six.
See, the reason I raise the question is when you think about it, suppose somebody is going to a psychiatrist for therapy. Doesn't want it known because there's a bias against it. He calls the shrink with regularity, and the shrink returns the calls with regularity. Might want to keep that pretty private. As opposed to, I drove my car to a location within four blocks of where the psychiatrist's office was. Why is the expectation greater in the one than in the other? It just doesn't jump out at me.
Well, I think
to which you might say the expectation ought to be recognized in both contexts.
Well,
and maybe that's right, and maybe we'll get there someday, but you've got to jump over a awful lot of third-party cases to do it.
Right, I don't think I need to make that argument, Your Honor. I think that going from to the psychologist's office and then going to pick up my kids and then going home, you're tracking a whole host of things that the phone toll records can't capture. And in fact, you can see in Davis's records where he slept at night. Some nights he slept at home, some nights he slept out. So,
Mr. Marcus, I wanted to follow up on that because my understanding of the record was that the government did elicit specifically information about where Mr. Davis slept from the Metro PCS expert witness.
They did. From that tower, they elicited that. What they didn't elicit, but what the record show and what the government had access to was two nights in September, he slept somewhere other than his home location. So
But the government didn't put that in evidence.
But that doesn't matter, Judge.
There's a quote from the prosecutor, detective, when you determine the home tower, is there a point in a person's day where that person goes to sleep? Answer, yes. And several questions later from the prosecutor. And so in this particular case, that home tower where the person is making the last call before the gap, which I would guess we would call sleep, and the first calls after the gap was the tower in Gould's. Answer, yes, it was.
That's it, Your Honor. That's it.
All right, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll hear now from Mr. Agarwal.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Assistant U.S. Attorney Amit Agarwal, appearing on behalf of the United States, and I'm pleased to be joined at counsel's table by my colleague, Amanda Perwin, from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Unless the Court would prefer otherwise, I'd like to start out by following up on Judge Martin's important question concerning the nature of the cell tower evidence that was used at this trial. With respect to whether these records could be used to pinpoint an individual's location inside of his home, I would respectfully direct the Court's attention to two parts of the record that we think make it clear that you couldn't establish that kind of pinpoint accuracy.
So, but the questions I read did come from the prosecutor to the Metro PCS witness, called by the prosecution.
So, Your Honor,
correct?
Yes, and Your Honor is raising a very important point, and that is that Detective Jacobs did analyze the records and draw an inference with respect to what the home area was. And the way he draws that inference is because over a long period of time, the last call at night and the first call in the morning tends to be using a handful of the same towers.
So they knew where he slept.
So you do know, you can make an inference, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct, with respect to what is the most likely place where an individual, the tower, general vicinity where an individual lives. Here's the critical point, is with this information, as Judge Hull points out, you could not determine that a person is inside his home, nor, as Judge Hull also pointed out, nor did we introduce any such incriminating evidence in this case. And the reason for that is, I just direct the court's attention respectfully to docket entry 285, pages 41 to 43.
But 49 to 52 is where the prosecutor asked those questions.
Yes, I believe you're referring to perhaps Michael Basilo's testimony, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
I believe you might be referring to Michael Basilo's testimony. If I could just clarify the nature of the testimony that I'm relying on, and then I'd be...
Well, I mean, I've got the transcript.
Here are two points that you might want to keep in mind, for whatever they're worth. One is that we had testimony that was undisputed in the record that an individual could be inside of his home, and he's sitting on his couch, he's making a telephone call, and he's using two different cell towers, which could be 1 to 1.5 miles apart. And that's at docket entry 285, pages 41 to 43. We also have undisputed testimony in the record that you could have two people in the same car sitting right next to each other using cell phones, and they're both using different towers that are, again, 1.5 miles apart. And that's docket entry 283, page 223.
Can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes.
The first is whether the government's position would change. Number one, if technology allowed the cell site information to specifically track a person's physical location to within 6 inches. And the second question is, would the government's position change if cell site information were technologically available without a person using his or her phone? In other words, if we progress in a year or 6 months or 2 years from now to the point where merely having your phone on, even without having a GPS function turned on, triggers cell site information, that's something that cell phone companies now want to track. So just having your cell phone with you gives you cell site information. Mm-hmm. Can you get that without a warrant?
So if I may address Your Honor's first question first.
Whatever order you'd like.
We anticipated that the court might put that entirely sensible and important practical question to us, and we formulated a three-part response. With the court's indulgence, I'll just briefly state the individual parts of our response, and then would be more than happy to elaborate on any part of the answer you'd like to hear more about. The first part of the answer is, under established Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, we think that probably the Fourth Amendment analysis doesn't come out any differently, even if we're talking about the kinds of records referred to by Your Honor in your first question, that is to say, precise, continuous location information. Second.
In other words, you can get it without a warrant. That's your...
Provided that the records have been maintained by a third party during the ordinary course of business and are lawfully in the possession of the third party, and also provided that the records are disclosed in compliance with all the statutory safeguards that are incorporated into the Stored Communications Act.
You'd have to get a court order to get it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The same court order that we obtained in this case under 18 U.S.C. Section 2703D.
But without...
So that's the first answer.
That's the first part of the answer. The second part is, we think that there are any number of ways that this court can sustain the constitutionality of the Stored Communications Act in this case, while still...
My question is a hypothetical about a different case.
Yes.
Because technology moves much more faster than courts do.
Yes.
And we need to sort of figure out how to write, regardless of how it is that we come out in this case.
I think Your Honor is absolutely right, and that was going to be the second part of my response, is to suggest that if that hypothetical poses an understandable concern to the court, we think that there are a number of ways that you could write this opinion where you could kind of, in a doctrinally principled and analytically coherent way, reserve judgment with respect to the admittedly somewhat more difficult question posed by Your Honor's hypothetical. And I'll give you two ways in particular.
So your position is you want to punt?
No, our position, Your Honor, to be candid with the court, our position, as I said in the first part of my answer, is we think under established Fourth Amendment principles, if the records are maintained in the ordinary course of business, they're lawfully possessed by the service provider, we think that falls squarely within the ambit of the third-party doctrine, even if you're talking about precise location information. The reason for that...
No, but the second part of the question was, if you are just being tracked because you've got a cell phone as a passive user. Mm-hmm. In other words, part of the telephone cases involve the person at the house with the landline dialing a number and the expectation that somebody at the telephone company is going to know what number you dialed and how long you were on the phone and the like. And so there's an argument to be made that if you are on your cell phone and you are dialing numbers, that's analogous to dialing numbers from a landline.
Yes.
But if you just have your cell phone on and you're not using it and you don't have the GPS feature turned on and they're still tracking you, your position is that with a court order, as long as you meet the statute, you don't need probable cause to get that information, right?
Yes, Your Honor, for the same reason why if a private investigator is tracking you unbeknownst to your knowledge over a long period of time, that may be unpleasant, maybe even it should be prohibited.
No, that's different. That's different because the private investigator is not the government.
You're absolutely...
People in the private realm can do that the government can't do.
Oh, absolutely, and I may have misunderstood Your Honor's question. If your question is whether the government can directly track the location of the cell phone...
No, the question is, uh-huh, this case, but assume the technology is that Mr. Davis did not use his phone at all. Mm-hmm. He just had it with him. Mm-hmm. And the telephone company was able to provide cell site information because now cell towers, mm-hmm, in a year from now, are able to figure out where you are and you can triangulate as well as you can now with an actual physical call. Mm-hmm. I think you've said your position is that you do not need probable cause and a warrant to get that information, mm-hmm, as long as the cell phone company is keeping it in the regular course of business.
That's right, and it's maintaining those records lawfully. Now, we're not suggesting
The part of the problem is that brings in the whole specter of Big Brother, as if Big Brother weren't around already. But, mm-hmm, and I don't know that it's determinative of this case, but the notion that government without a warrant can track you physically without probable cause and know your every move is somewhat troubling. It has no stopping point.
It is.
You want to help me with that?
It is troubling, Your Honor. It's an extraordinarily important question. And our response to it is this. We do not ask this court to countenance anything even remotely resembling the prospect of governmental tracking of all citizens' precise location information 24 hours a day without any judicial supervision. We're not asking for that authority.
No, you get judicial supervision here. I completely understand that that's what the Stored Communications Act provides. I'm not suggesting you're going out there on your own and stealing it or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You're going to a court and getting a court order.
Right.
My question concerns the probable cause requirement.
Yes.
It's not a question of whether you can get it or not.
Yes.
It's what you have to show to get it.
Right.
And you understand, practically speaking, that if you prevail in this case, the government will almost never try to seek a warrant. Right? There's no need. I mean, if you can get something based on reasonable suspicion, why in the world would you ask a court for a warrant based on probable cause? So you understand that if you win, basically, a portion of the Stored Communications Act is going to be rendered largely ineffectual.
That
the government will never, ever, ever go through the trouble of seeking an order based on probable cause?
Well, that we do not agree with, because there are certain kinds of records that are maintained by phone companies or create information that's within the possession of the phone companies that we do obtain pursuant to the warrant procedure set out in Section 2703C1 capital A.
Like what?
Like real-time cell site data. There are a lot of district courts that require us as a matter of statutory interpretation.
But that's not because you want to. You're being forced to.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and if you're allowed to do as you wish, mm-hmm. my suggestion to you is that you might keep going until somebody stops you, which is a natural instinct of any litigant. No?
Your Honor, I think it's important to keep in mind, because you raised the specter of Big Brother, and so let's talk about what we're looking at here. We're looking at the government.
Before you leave that question, I gather your answer is that the warrant requirement is in there because you reach a point to where 2703C on the non-warrant requirement, just the order, might be constitutionally problematic.
There are some cases in which it might be, and Your Honor is right, that the C1A procedure could be invoked in those circumstances.
And all we have before us here is whether a warrant's required given the data that you sought in this case.
That's absolutely right, and that data, as Judge Hull pointed out, is depicted visually on government's exhibits 37A to 37F.
Right. And we could hold in this case that a warrant was not required, but in a full tracking 24/7 case, it was required. That would be a logical and rational position to take.
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of Your Honor's
question. We could hold in another case that full-time 24/7 continuous tracking did require a warrant.
Sure, you absolutely could, and we'd respectfully direct the Court's attention to the Supreme Court's decision in United States v. Knotts, where the Supreme Court...
That's correct. That's a good place to go to Knotts. Mm-hmm. And one final record question here. I should have asked Mr. Marcus, and I'm going to ask him to see if he agrees with you. And this is a follow-up to Judge Jordan's question. As I understand the record in this case, this phone, if it was on, was not tracked by Metro PCS. The only records we have in this whole case is that the phone has got to be on and it's got to be sending a call or receiving a call. And the record is undisputed that when Mr. Davis's phone was on, there's no data points, there's nothing being gathered. Is that correct?
That is exactly
okay.
Right.
So it would be great to do other cases, but this one's hard enough. Okay. Now go back to your Knotts point, because I think Knotts is helpful here.
The holding of the Supreme Court in Knotts was that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in public location information that could have been obtained through ordinary visual surveillance. Not that was obtained through ordinary visual surveillance, but could have been obtained. It's an extraordinarily broad holding, because what it said is that the government can get public location information even with the aid of an electronic device surreptitiously installed in an item that the suspect obtained from a third party with the collusion of the government, without any judicial supervision, without any statutory authority, and without any congressional regulation of the kind that we find incorporated into the Stored Communications Act. And in light of the breadth of that holding, as you might imagine, the defendants in Knotts raised questions very similar to the legitimate practical concerns that Judge Jordan articulated, which is that raises the specter of dragnet-type law enforcement tactics characterized by 24-hour-a-day surveillance of any citizen for any reason without any judicial supervision.
And I don't get how this isn't 24 hours a day. It's 67 days, right?
Yes,
67
Your
days. 5,803 calls.
Yes, Your Honor.
11,606 cell site location data points.
Yes, Your Honor.
And testimony from a government witness about where he slept. Right?
Your Honor, if I may clarify one point on that last, the only part I slightly disagree with you on is the last part, The reason why his home tower and the general vicinity location associated with his home tower was relevant is because Mr. Davis was trying to argue to the jury.
Well, relevant or not, the government solicited that testimony from its expert.
But for the purpose, for a very specific purpose, and that wasn't to incriminate Mr. Davis. That was to make it clear that while he was at, that while his phone was in the vicinity of those six robberies, that that wasn't his home tower location, because if it had been his home tower location, that would have been exculpatory. And that was a point that defense counsel argued in closing argument. You'll find that at docket entry 287.
So it depends on what purpose for which the government wants to disclose to a jury where somebody slept.
Your Honor, I guess the point is we didn't use the tower location information to reveal any incriminating information about activities that are taking place in a constitutionally protected space like a home. The only information, incriminating information, that's introduced into evidence, as Judge Hull pointed out, is the cell tower data visually depicted at Government's Exhibits 37A to 37A.
So you only had a radius of where he slept, of a mile. No, none of this data told us where he slept.
That is exactly
right. We had a radius of a mile where he may have slept.
That is
in Smith, we knew where he slept.
We knew where he slept.
Because Smith landlines were tied to precise addresses, and that was Smith's main argument. I'm in my house. You can't get my telephone numbers from my house.
Your Honor is absolutely right, both about the pen register data,
right,
the use of which was approved by the Supreme Court in Smith, but also, you're right by implication, about all the other kinds of third-party business records that are out there, all of which, or a lot of which, reveal much more precise location-related information than the general vicinity information circumstantially discernible from the cell tower records at issue here. And let's just go through the list of some of those records, all of which are concededly obtainable with a simple subpoena under established Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. Pen register records, credit card statements, bank statements, utility records, medical records, electronic toll booths, hotel guest registry records, airline manifests, the list goes on and on. Video surveillance tapes, a lot of these kinds of third-party evidence disclose much more specific location information and much more intimate aspects.
And you get that with a subpoena without judicial oversight.
That's exactly right.
And I like the line in your brief when you say this case is not about lowering the bar from a warrant to a court order. This is raising the bar from a subpoena to having to go get a court order. That's really what this case is about.
Your
and
Honor,
that was a good line in that brief.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. It's along that line.
But it also suggests that perhaps the Congress of the United States might at some point be the best body to address the kind of advancing technological problems that Judge Jordan was raising.
I think that is exactly right, Your Honor. And in fact, that is one of the most fundamental differences between our position and the position of our friends on the other side. We are not asking this court to mechanically apply old precedents and understandings to the facts and the circumstances that are present here. We're not asking for privacy protection in the 21st century to be regulated primarily by the blunt instrument of the Fourth Amendment, as Justice Alito put it in his Riley concurrence. Our central point, and we think the central teaching of the Alito concurrence in Jones, on which our friends on the other side rely so heavily, is that these problems are hard. We don't think they're easy. There are a lot of new technologies that are out there. They raise the concerns that Judge Jordan properly raised. Nobody knows what the future looks like. Those technologies, as Justice Alito pointed out in his concurrence, are affecting expectations.
I want to ask
privacy.
You about the third-party doctrine.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I have my personal email through ATT and I send emails, can you, without getting a warrant, obtain information about to whom I send emails?
Your Honor, that question is dictated by or controlled by at the very, let me say this.
Yes.
So I think for purposes of this case, the court should proceed on the assumption that we need to get a warrant in order to get emails. That's the assumption on which the government is proceeding. And the only reason I hesitate just a little bit before giving you a categorical yes or no answer is because my understanding, based on this court's decision in Reberg v. Paulk, is that the law of this circuit is currently unclear on that point.
So is that content to whom I send the email?
No.
I'm to whom I send it.
No, Your Honor, it's not.
You know sender, you know sendee.
That's right. So that's routing-related information.
And you need a warrant to get that.
Oh, no. For the routing-related information, I don't believe that we would need a warrant.
That's what I understood.
That would be...
Okay, what about time of day?
For time of day, I believe would be routing-related information as well.
So no warrant.
And it would be analogous to the time when you send a FedEx package or the time when you put a letter in the envelope. Or to whom you put that letter in the envelope, to whom you
number of emails. Same thing. That's routing information. You're entitled to without a warrant.
Under established Supreme Court jurisprudence, yes, Your Honor. And I'd respectfully direct the court's attention to Katz v. United States, United States v. Jacobson, Smith v. Maryland, all of which make a fundamental distinction as a matter of Fourth Amendment law between outside the envelope.
Let me ask you about this. So assume my nephew is... using his ATT internet to visit a dating site. Can you get that information without a warrant?
I'm sorry, is using...
The fact that he goes to a dating website.
So the fact that the user is putting in a particular URL, my understanding is that there's circuit precedent out there that holds that that's not covered by a reasonable expectation of privacy. I do want to say that we acknowledge that when you start going down that road, that starts to implicate content-like concerns that pose more difficult problems than the one that's posed here. And
but
I don't want to...
Time of day... Well, I mean, we've got to write a rule, and I'm just trying to...
Absolutely.
So time of day... So what if it's my married next-door neighbor visiting a dating website? Can you get time of day?
You're married...
That he visits it? Well, it doesn't... I mean, my next-door neighbor is visiting a dating site. What about time of day? Can you get that information? Time of day he visits it. That's routing information, right? Under your theory, you don't need a warrant to know that.
Yes.
Okay. What about connections that he, you know, people that he talks to, not what they say, but people that he talks to on the dating website?
Sure.
You can get that information without a warrant?
Your Honor, I want to be clear. I don't know the answers to all these questions, but by way of analogy to what we do know, which is, for example, the pen register data that tells you who a person is talking to, who's calling me, who am I calling, I would say by way of analogy, that probably does fall within the ambit of the third-party doctrine. Obviously, that's not the question that's presented here.
All right. Whether they meet, whether he meets with one of the people that he got in contact with on a dating website. Can you get that information?
Your Honor, I think it's important to, in assessing that question and others like it, I think it's important to make a distinction between the nature of the information that's obtained and how it's obtained. And as we understand it, under established Supreme Court jurisprudence, the application of the Fourth Amendment depends on both. So there may be some ways you can get that information and other ways that you can't. If a third party is lawfully in possession...
But none of which require a warrant, so far
no,
in my hypothetical.
No, some of which would. And you can
But I mean, what the examples I've given you so far, you've every step of the way said no warrant, no warrant.
Your Honor, as I understood it, your hypotheticals addressed routing-related data that would be lawfully...
Well, that's what you call it.
Yes.
Okay, but... You know, who a person has contacted on a dating website, you get that information without a warrant because it's routing information.
So
I think that's what you said, right?
Who you're communicating with on a dating website. I'm not as sure about that, Your Honor. If it's a communication between two identifiable endpoints, like we're talking about here, then we know that that's routing-related data that's subject to the ambit of the third-party rule. If what you're talking about is a kind of conversation that's sort of happening on the website, then I don't think the government can hack into your website and find out who you're talking to.
You're making the the content, no content distinction?
Well, that's not us making the distinction. That's a distinction that is a fixture of Fourth Amendment law, and we have no quarrel with the proposition that as a general principle, individuals do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of their communications. And perhaps by way of analogy to sufficiently content-like data as well. That's entirely possible. But what we're talking about here is classic routing-related data that has conceitedly nothing to do with the contents of a communication. We're talking about what cell tower is used
to route a call. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of the arguments that the government made to the jury. I guess, you know, one of the premises of your argument here is that Mr. Davis voluntarily shared his cell tower location information with a third party, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And, of course, to the jury, you're arguing, well, there's one thing he didn't know, was that we could track him.
Sure.
And so how do you get to have it both ways?
The reason is because there's a difference between voluntary activity and knowing activity. In this case, all the activity that Mr. Davis engaged in that allowed Metro PCS to get the location-related information that Mr. Davis sought to suppress was uncoerced. That is to say, nobody forced him to get the phone. Nobody forced him to take it with him to the sites of 6 armed robberies. Nobody forced him to activate a phone service that works by communicating with and thereby revealing.
That's true of my Google account.
Sure.
If I go on a shopping site, I sign away every privacy interest I have in that information, right? I mean, we all do, right?
Your Honor is right that because conduct is voluntary, that doesn't mean that it's culpable. But if it's uncoerced, it is voluntary in our view within the meaning of Smith and Miller. And it would be problematic if the government forced someone.
If you follow that to the end, I don't know how you don't get content then.
Mm-hmm.
So, just making that voluntary distinction,
yeah.
How do you keep from getting how do I keep you from getting content?
Yeah, part of the answer is, Your Honor, when I'm sending you a letter, that's not the business record of the postal office. And if it is a business record of the postal office, and there are lots of kinds of content that are subject to the third-party rule. See, for example, if I sent you an email, I no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the email that's now in your possession, and the government could subpoena that email, and my Fourth Amendment rights would not even be implicated. There are a lot of Supreme Court cases that say that, including the cases that are cited in Smith and Miller for the proposition that conversations that are taking place in the inside of a home are not the subject of a reasonable expectation of privacy so long as one of the parties to that conversation is working with the government.
Even accepting your content, no content distinction, I think this case is a great example of how much you can know about somebody from metadata. If you're tracking metadata from my other next door neighbor, and you see that, to follow up on Judge Marcus's example, she's gone to her doctor. The next call is to an oncologist. The next call is to a hospital setting up to the scheduling department of a hospital. You know a lot of personal information about that person based on the metadata without ever looking at the content.
Your Honor is absolutely right, but we don't think that that possibility of either data aggregation on the one hand or of extracting meaningful information from the metadata on the other hand provides a persuasive basis for distinguishing cases like Smith and Miller. For example, as Justice Brennan pointed out in an eloquent and impassioned dissent in Miller, an individual's bank records taken as a whole constitute, in his words, quote, a virtual current biography. So it has always been true that these kinds of third-party business records can reveal information that a lot of us might prefer to keep confidential. That doesn't mean that those records can't be disclosed pursuant to a court order issued by a neutral and detached magistrate.
Without probable cause.
Authorized by Congress and accompanied by all the statutory safeguards that are incorporated into the SCA. I see that my time has run out.
It has indeed. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
You know, Mr. Marcus, this issue that we've spent all our time discussing is an interesting and important one. It's what attracted the green briefs, but it's no bigger issue for your clients sitting in prison than the good faith exception issue, which is what the panel actually affirmed the case on. So you need to speak to us about why, in particular, as I understand it, the precedent is with a statute of Congress permitting something, it has to be clearly unconstitutional for the good faith exception not to apply. And in this case, tell us why it's clearly unconstitutional if the Fifth Circuit thinks it's constitutional.
Sure. And there's a lot of reasons the good faith exception doesn't apply here, Judge. And let me start with the statute didn't say you just can get a D order without probable cause. There is a choice that the prosecutor had here.
I understand, but that choice was in the statute when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the constitutionality of the statute.
Well, here the prosecutor obtained the D order way before the Fifth Circuit ruled.
It doesn't matter. If the Fifth Circuit says it's constitutional, why does that not tell us that a reasonable objective view, a reasonable officer could have believed it wasn't clearly unconstitutional?
Because no reasonable officer acted here. It wasn't a law enforcement.
It's an objective test, is it not?
Absolutely.
Okay,
Judge.
So the question is whether any objectively reasonable officer could have believed this statute was not clearly unconstitutional, unless you're willing to say that the judges on the Fifth Circuit don't rise to the level of objective reasonableness. How can we hold that the exclusionary rule applies?
For a number of reasons. First, I'd say there's no factual scenario even close to this that has ever been presented on good faith. What we have here is not a police officer or a law enforcement officer acting in good faith. We have a prosecutor who made a choice to proceed under the statute, while at the time there was case law suggesting it was unconstitutional.
Yeah, but you don't freeze it at the time. If the Supreme Court later upholds the statute, you can't say it was unreasonable because at that time they hadn't done that.
I understand, but what we have here is a prosecutor who, in his shoes, the objective person in his shoes, had a choice to make. They assumed the risk that by proceeding under this choice, by proceeding under the part of the statute not requiring a warrant, that it may later be found unconstitutional by this court.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that the good faith exception doesn't apply.
Oh, sure. The good faith exception is there for law enforcement officers who are acting, for example, in Leon on a warrant, or...
So it doesn't apply to statutes? Of course it applies to statutes.
It applies to statutes. In Kroll, there was a statute that authorized the conduct. Here, there was a statute that had a choice to be made by a prosecutor. The prosecutor, who's assumed to be learned in the law...
And the Fifth Circuit held
afterwards
that choosing 2703C was not unconstitutional.
Sure. Afterwards, in a 2-1 decision, they did hold that, Your Honor. But an objective prosecutor acting at that time assumes the risk that by proceeding in that...
If you say assumes the risk that it'll be held unconstitutional, that means there is no good faith exception because it turns on whether it's later held unconstitutional.
No, because in this case, this is a very unique factual scenario, Judge Carnes, where there is a choice in the statute to be made. The whole point of the good faith exception is to deter conduct in the future. Here, No,
that's not the purpose of the good faith exception. The purpose of the good faith exception is to provide an exception to the exclusionary rule, part of which is deterrence, and says we shouldn't exact the price of that comes with deterrence if there's an objective, reasonable basis for thinking the statute is not clearly unconstitutional.
And the reason for that exception is because you're not going to deter somebody who acted pursuant to some good faith law or good faith position. Here we didn't have that. We had a prosecutor acting who had two choices to make. And he chose a path. Well, at the time there was case law suggesting to him from the Third Circuit and from different district courts that his path proceeded with peril. So there is a deterrence aspect here to it. And that's, I think, the important distinction between this case and other cases on good faith. I will just go back for a second to the precision argument because I think it's so important. It was precise enough back in this case in 2010, 5 years ago, that the prosecutor argued it and stressed it in his rebuttal closing argument that this was the ultimate evidence proving that Mr. Davis committed the crime. That's how precise the data was in this case. He held up those maps and argued to the jury, this proves that Mr. Davis was at these six bank robberies. That's how precise the data was. In terms of 24/7 monitoring, that's exactly what we have here, as Judge Martin raised. Exactly what we have here. 67 days worth of around-the-clock monitoring. 11,000 points of data. Every 8 minutes, they knew where Mr. Davis was. Every 8 minutes. And this is technology from 5 years ago. We are way, way past that now. Way, way past that. They can now triangulate you to within a few meters. By the way, Judge Jordan, when you asked whether the government is asking for data when your phone is just turned on, in that Fifth Circuit case that Judge Carnes mentioned, they asked for that data. It is available now. The problem right now is the storage capacity of the service providers isn't big enough to hold it, but it will be soon. The government is already...
What about this case? Was when the phone was on, am I correct, there was no data collected by Metro PCS?
When the phone was just
on. When Mr. Davis's phone was on.
Correct.
There was no data collected.
Except when he received a call passively.
Or made a call.
Or made a call.
I just wanted to clarify that record.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
But the receiving the call is important, Judge Hull, because receiving a call, Mr. Davis didn't do anything. All he passively sat there and his phone rang. Whether he answered the call or not, it still recorded that data point. So it's very, very different than the pen register cases. And I think it's really important to focus on this argument by the government that no one forced him to have a phone. I mean, think about what the government is saying there. An argument, by the way, that has been completely rejected by a 9-0 court, Justice Roberts, in the Riley decision. We all have
Everybody
phones.
Needs a phone. We know that.
Yes, Your Honor. So
really?
But think about what the government's saying when they said he voluntarily had the phone with him. That argument is going to lead, if we follow it through, all of us sitting in places without our phones with us. And what Justice Roberts says is that's unheard of for him. I do want to address this subpoena idea that just because you can get lots of things by a subpoena, that sort of makes this question irrelevant. And I think the perfect example is Kylo, because the prosecutor mentioned...
It's not that it makes it irrelevant. It's that Congress might very well impose a higher standard on the government than would ordinarily apply if they were just going to get a subpoena, right?
I understand that, Judge Pryor, but here's the point I'd like
and
to
sometimes
make.
Sometimes Congress is the best one to make that determination, right?
Sometimes, but the reason I started off with that point about 1986 and the Stored Communications Act is Congress hasn't done anything on this in 30 years. We're stuck with a clunky old statute that does not apply to today, and to rely on them to try to come up with something now, I think we're going to be waiting a while. That's why we have courts to step in and put a check on the government when they want to monitor us for 67 days around the clock without probable cause. That's why we have you all, to step in and say, no, that's not enough.
You have us to enforce the Constitution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here, what the Constitution says with regard to subpoenas is sometimes subpoenas are enough. For example, with utility records, like the prosecutor points out. But that doesn't mean that you can use a thermal imager to get the same exact stuff, how much heat is coming off the house. Justice Scalia said you may be able to get that from a subpoena on the utility records, but you can't get it through a thermal imager. You may be able to get certain things.
Could you get records here for on the 7 days of the robbery? Let's say you asked for 7 days of record. Would that have been okay? If they got a warrant. But you say they couldn't even get just the 7 days here without a warrant.
That's right, Judge.
So you say they cannot per se get cell site data. That's really your position.
They can get it with a warrant.
Understand.
This is very important because
they cannot get cell site data with a court order under the Stored Communications Act.
Correct.
That would be unconstitutional.
Absolutely. And I would end that argument with the same way Justice Roberts ended with Riley. It's not hard to get a warrant. All they had to do was say, here's the 7 days that these robberies occur. What they did in the order. We're not asking for an awful lot here.
In fact, the order had abundant probable cause in it, did it not?
Only for 7 days, Judge Carnes.
I know, but abundant probable cause.
Absolutely. But I think this is a really important point. It didn't have probable cause for the other 60 days.
You know, I'm not sure about your no probable cause for 7 days, because if they were, in fact, committing these robberies during the 7 days, they could have been planning it calls back and forth for weeks beforehand.
Okay, so they could have used the pen register for that, but the location for those other 60 days are irrelevant.
No, but we were talking about whether the pre-7-day period was relevant to probable cause that they may have committed the robbery.
Okay, so there could be an argument about that, and they could ask for a warrant by swearing to an affidavit and putting the facts in there. They didn't do that. That was a choice they made. I see my time's just about up.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. I can see from looking out on the faces of all of y'all that you could use a break. So we're going to take a... Oh, Mr.
He did a good job. Mr.
Marcus, Judge Hull reminds me that you were court-appointed. We appreciate you accepting that appointment. And your co-counsel as well. And she reminds me that both sides did a good job. And so we'll take a 15-minute break.
Valerie.
I thought you did a really good job. Don't
sit. You're here?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Pitiful. Okay. I'm going to take the front. You would take these two papers. No, because that's that case. Do it next.